Welcome to Water of the Word, the radio ministry of Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Join us today as Pastor Steve continues through a verse-by-verse study of the book of Zechariah. Though written more than 500 years before Jesus, this powerful little book has much to say about today's headlines, as well as deep insight into the Lord's work and ministry in the lives of believers right now. So come on along. May we all be refreshed and inspired as we are washed by the water of the Word.
We've all been there. We see these events on TV and we're like, what was that? And we're tempted to think, oh, what's going on? It's out of control. No, it's not. As we will see in Zechariah chapter 9. In this broken economy, until he comes back and fixes it in the book of Revelation. Until then, here's what he does. He takes what the devil has intended for evil, and he turns it around for amazing glory. That's what he does. You know, it was 13 years ago when the Columbine shooting, and you know who the first person who was shot? 17-year-old Rachel Scott, eating lunch. Did you know that she literally went to kindergarten and many classes up into her senior year, I believe it was, with Dylan Klebold, one of the shooters? She, of course, was killed, and here's what happened. All these years later, let's not forget, Rachel's Challenge Foundation was formed out of that terrible tragedy. What is that? Her father, her younger brother, also a student at Columbine at that time, and even her mother, had been tirelessly traveling the nation, getting this Rachel's Challenge in effect. They have visited, listen, tens of thousands of students over thousands of classrooms, junior high and high school, making people aware of bullying, of looking for people who feel outcast and being a part of reaching you, be a part of reaching in and pulling them into your various social networks. Did you know that there is potentially tens of thousands of students who have benefited from Rachel Scott Challenge? After her funeral, of which 3,000 attended, it was divulged that she had kept several journals. Six journals of Rachel Scott have been published. And one of the lines in one of her diaries read something along the lines, "Oh God," she was a born-again Christian, if you didn't know. "Oh God, may you use my life to touch thousands." What the devil intended for evil, what does God always do, family? He turns it around and he gets glory from it. Let's get into now, if you would, Zechariah chapter 9. Let me show you. It's going to be a bit of a history lesson. And yes, I am aware that the church growth gurus are saying, now be careful because, you know, people can only sort of withstand maybe 20 minutes. But you know, you got to spread things out. You got to dazzle them with multimedia. And I'm all about multimedia. I love multimedia. But with all that, you'd better preach the gospel. And I want to let you know something. It is going to be an intellectual exercise this morning. Would you mind hanging in with me and tuning in? And here's why. Zechariah, 150 years before it happened, is going to prophesy and tell us about Alexander the Great. In chapter 11, it's going to tell us about the Roman Empire. At the last part of chapter 9, as we'll see here, it's going to tell us about an amazing time in the chapter of the history of the nation of Israel, the Maccabean Revolt. A fabulous, amazing time, 300 years before it even happened. We're going to spend some time in Exodus chapter 13, and you're going to find out, why did Jesus come in on a donkey? Well, because he couldn't get an upgrade. It hurts rental donkeys, so. Come to find out, Jesus riding on that donkey was a powerful Levitical picture. Zechariah chapter 9. This is many years after chapters 1 through 8. Zechariah now is a seasoned, tried, and proven prophet. No longer centered on the temple, now long completed, God is going to show him this peculiar idea and understanding of two, sort of, messiahs. Now, how many messiahs do we have, really? Well, just the one. But here is Zechariah, so to speak, standing on the summit of God's knowledge, and he sees to the mountaintop of the first advent or the first arrival of Jesus. And then he sees the second advent of Jesus, but his perspective is sort of one next to another. Because of his perspective, he doesn't, so to speak, perceive the valley in between, the valley of time and space. And this dual description of the Messiah puzzled the rabbis, and to a large degree still does. Because in Isaiah 53, the Messiah is going to be what? Beaten beyond recognition? By his stripes we are healed? He was pierced for our iniquities? And all the sin was put upon him? What? But then you read in other places, no, Messiah is coming back. He's going to kick. He's going to really do well when he comes back. And with a word from his mouth, all of his adversaries are dispatched. Well, what is it? Is it a suffering Messiah or is it a triumphal Messiah? The answer is yes, it is both. We have the privilege of hindsight. We understand that there was a gap of time in between. His first advent, he came as a baby in the manger of Bethlehem. But he's going to come again the second time as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He came into Jerusalem that first time on his appointed day, not on a white steed snorting with fierceness like all the other conquerors did. He came in on a what, everybody? A what? Lord, who is your PR man? But when he comes back in Revelation 19, everybody, now what is he riding? Chapters 9 through 11, we're going to see here Messiah's first coming. And I want you to notice, he's going to talk about the history to us, future to them, the history that was going to happen before that would set the stage. In chapters 12 through 14, he's going to be speaking of Messiah's second coming. That's going to be some wonderful stuff. And he's going to speak about the history, future to us, of what's going to be happening. Oh, that Israel would have paid attention to Zechariah, telling in advance the history, what things were going to look like before the first advent of the Lord. And we cluck our tongue and say, what a bunch of losers. If we're not careful, we will miss chapters 12, 13, and 14 because he lays it out, what it's going to look like, what will be prevalent throughout our society right before his second return. And one of them is, hey, watch out. CNN is covering it. A two-state political system in Israel, a peace treaty. Have you been hearing a little something about that? Verses 1 through 9 of our chapter tonight, we're going to see Alexander the Great prophesied in full color. Chapter 11, we're going to see the Roman Empire. Chapter 12 through 14 was going to prophesy Israel in the very last days. Now, here we go. You ready? Chapter 9, verse 1. And I want you to notice that there is a series of cities that are mentioned. What is this? These cities are, in order, those that Alexander the Great conquered on his conquest into the region, on his way to Cleopatra and Egypt. You're going to see here, you're going to see some of these lands. It is the path that Alexander took on his conquest through the region after the Battle of Issus in 333 BC. Remember in the first part of Zechariah, we saw four chariots prophesied. God is going to be using Alexander the Great to bring judgment on the below-mentioned nations. Because, why? Because of their ill treatment of Israel. What did God say to Abraham? Israel is the apple of my eye. And whoever blesses you, Abraham, and by inference, his descendants, the Jewish race, the Jewish people, whoever messes with you, messes with me. Whoever blesses you, I will bless. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And is God watching when people mistreat his land of Israel? Verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord against the land of Hadrach. For the longest time, and forgive me, I'm going to move around to another subject matter. Have you ever heard me say before that the Bible has been 80% archaeologically substantiated? Did you know that in the 1850s and following, there was a tremendous surge of archaeology that was done in the region of what we know today as the Holy Land or the Middle East? And it was a well-known idiom. If you're going to do any historical work and try to dig and unearth ancient peoples and cities, you better have your trowel in the one hand and your Bible in the other hand. The Bible would say such and such and so was a place or a city. And the higher educated of the 1850s up until the turn of the 1900s said, that Bible, pshaw, pshaw, it's just a kind of a collection of musings put together by humans. This city right here, Hadrach, that even taught in some liberal seminaries of the middle 1800s said, there was no such place. Until the year 1903, guess what they found? They found something called the Stele of Zechar, which was a king of guess what city? Hadrach. All right, see what he's saying. I'm just saying academia sometimes is way behind the Bible. And in those days, up until 1903, people were saying there was no such place until somebody did some digging, and guess what they found? It turns out the Bible was right. Let's move on. Damascus, you might have heard about that city. That's still alive today. Did you know that Damascus is one of the oldest continually inhabited cities of the world? Is it still there today? Is it still the capital of Syria? It sure is. Its resting place for the eyes of men and all the tribes of Israel are on the Lord. What the prophet is saying is, everybody, when these judgment happens and these cities fall one after the other to Alexander the Great, the people of Israel are going to go, wait a minute, these are the same cities that God promised. He said, I was watching when they mistreated Israel. And here is Alexander the Great, a factual man, personage of history. Here is God using him to do what? To accomplish his will. Does God use non-saved people? Well, I know that God used a donkey once. Balaam's donkey. And if he can speak through a donkey, there's hope for our political system. Verse 2. And against Hamath, which borders it, this was a formidable kingdom of King Zechar that he ruled. The Assyrians, turns out, battled these people significantly. And against Tyre and Sidon, we know that as modern-day Lebanon. Tyre, by the way, was a city that was an island. And it was sort of ruled by a group of people that were founded by a formidable naval society called the Phoenicians. They had a little island about a half a mile offshore, and they built on this island walls that were 150 feet high. And the only way you could get there was a shuttle service from the mainland. And because it was so secure, a lot of banks were there. And with that, they became pretty wealthy. They were very wealthy. And in fact, Tyre is ruled by a king, and we saw on Wednesday in Ezekiel 28, the king has his sort of responsibility for making and raising that idolatrous, money-soaked, commerce-consumed people. But you know, in Ezekiel 28, do you know who the Bible says was behind this insatiable appetite to consume? Was the devil himself. Against Tyre and Sidon, and so though they are wise, they were rich and they were crafty. The citadel, as I said, walls 150 feet high, and they were about a half a mile offshore. Who's going to get them? They withstood a five-year siege by the mighty Assyrians under a fellow by the name of Shalmaneser the Fourth. I wish we had force like that again. I am Steve the 12th. Thank you. They survived a 13-year siege of the Babylonian army under the mighty Nebuchadnezzar and turned them away. Alexander the Great showed up of their 40,000 population. They shipped off children and the women to a safer location, and 40,000 armed people a half a mile off the shore from 150-foot walls that came right out of the sea, and they went like this to Alexander the Great. Neener, neener, neener. And what did Alexander the Great do? In 7 months, he had destroyed the city. How did he do it? He built a causeway from the mainland to Tyre that is there still to this day. It's quite a story. He built mobile ramparts that were these wooden structures that were over 40 feet tall. And he invented machines that would at the one time stave off flaming arrows, because that was what you did. You shot flaming arrows into the wood structure, and he figured out a way around that. And within 7 months, he destroyed the city. The proud, rich people, ha, we have money, we have bank accounts, we have 401ks. Stuffed. We don't need God, we don't need anybody, and you, Alexander, neener, neener, come and get us what you got. In 7 months, he had destroyed the city of Tyre. That's what the history books say. Do you know what God says? God says, that was me. Because as you get into the history of what the Tyrenians and what they did in the Phoenicians and how they treated God's people, God was watching. Verse 3, for Tyre built herself a tower, heaped up silver like dust, and gold like the mire on the streets. Ezekiel 27 verse 3 says that Tyre was hugely wealthy. And as I said, Ezekiel 28 also says that behind that insatiable hunger to succeed monetarily was the devil himself. Behold, the Bible continues, behold, the Lord will cast her out. What did your history books, what did they say? Who did they say defeated the city of Tyre? That Alexander. What is God saying? I did that. God will destroy her power in the sea, and she will be devoured by fire. Verse 5, Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall be very sorrowful. The next several cities we're going to see are Philistine cities. Did the Philistines ever give the Jews a hard time? God was watching. And interestingly enough, these are the cities in progression that Alexander the Great conquered one after the other. Ashkelon shall see it in fear. Gaza also shall be sorrowful. Ekron, for he, the Lord, dried up her expectation. The king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. A mixed race shall settle in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. Alexander's campaign through Philistine country. If you're taking notes, Amos 1 verse 6, Zephaniah 2 verse 4, all prophesy that God is going to set at right the Philistine indiscretions against the Jews. Moving on, I will take away the blood from his mouth, the abominations from between his teeth, but he who remains, even he, shall be for our God, and shall be like a leader in Judah. And Ekron, a formerly Philistine stronghold, will be like a Jebusite, that is to say, one who dwells in Jerusalem. Now that part hasn't happened yet. We looked at that last week, that when Jesus sets up his 1,000-year reign in the millennial reign of Christ, how many people are going to be converts to believers in Jesus Christ? So what's the answer? Everybody. And remember, last week we saw that at that time, 10 men are going to grab the sleeve of one Jewish person and say, please take me to your city, Jerusalem, because you have the way of the living God. That hasn't happened yet, this last little portion where former Philistines are going to be leaders in God's house. Hasn't happened yet. That's coming in the millennial reign. Verse 8. I will camp around my house, says the Lord. Because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. Now this is speaking of Alexander. What you and I see forms what we think. I want to enlighten you this morning that there has history has transpired that you might not be aware of. And I want to let you know about history. What's the old adage? Those that don't learn from history are destined to repeat it. It's a little known fact that when Alexander was approaching Jerusalem on his way to Egypt, knocking out city after city, fortress after fortress, Tyre was wiped out. And the terror of everybody fell upon the people that were cowering in his path. The high priest of Jerusalem and of Israel was a guy by the name of Jediah. And Jediah at first said, no, we're going to hold our siege against Alexander the Great. But then God appears to him in a dream and says, don't you do that. He, Alexander, is my instrument. Don't forget Zechariah chapter 9. So what Jediah does is he gets a contingency of other teachers and priests. He walks out of the safety of the walled city of Jerusalem, meets Alexander under a flag of truce. Alexander says, what are you doing? He says, I got to show you something in my Bible. He shows him Zechariah chapter 9 with these cities set in order. And Alexander goes, hey, that's the exact way that I came here conquesting. And then Jediah says, yeah, because there is a God who is using you as his instrument. And he doesn't stop there. He also shows them Daniel chapter 8. If you get a chance, cruise through there. We treated that in our Daniel study and find out that it is very descriptive of Alexander the Great. Alexander saw himself in Bible prophecy and said, whoa, that's pretty awesome. He instead offers a lamb of sacrifice on the altar of Israel. He leaves Jerusalem intact on his way to destroy Egypt. That's what Zechariah 9 is talking about. How many of you are just a little like, whoa, that's in my Bible? Would that be like George Patton in the Third Army saying, time out, King Zex, to Rommel and saying, here is your battle plan. And Rommel goes, where did you get these? I got them in my Bible. That didn't happen with Patton and Rommel, but it did happen with the high priest of Jerusalem and one of the greatest military commanders of all time. And Alexander is so impressed by seeing himself in Zechariah 9 and Daniel chapter 8 that he spared the city. That happened, everybody. It happened. Going on, no more shall an oppressor pass through them, for now I have seen with my eyes. Now this is speaking of the millennial reign, because has Jerusalem been trodden after Alexander? Yes. But in the millennial reign, write Joel chapter 3 verse 17, I'll read it to you. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, Jerusalem, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no alien shall ever pass through her gate again. Verse 9. Moving on, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. That's a colloquial term for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Don't worry, inhabitants of Jerusalem. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, and he is just, having salvation, lowly, and riding on a white steed. What's he riding on, everybody? A donkey, a colt, a foal of a donkey. The triumphal entry of Jesus. And the young Jewish disciples that were with him, when they were approaching Jerusalem, and Jesus said to Peter, James, and John, go get the donkey. Did these Jewish kids know their Bible? They knew Zechariah 9, verse 9. And did they get excited about that? Woo! What did that mean?
You've been listening to the Book of Zechariah with Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. We hope these Old Testament truths have been helpful models of just how powerfully God works right now in the life and ministry of every believer. If you missed any of today's message or would like to hear it in its full unedited format, you can watch this or any of Pastor Steve's teachings at our website. Just visit us at harvestreno.org. That's www.harvestreno.org. Come join us Sundays at 10:30 and Wednesday evenings at 6:30. Harvest is located at 350 South Rock Boulevard in Reno. Until next time, Pastor Steve encourages all of us to follow Acts 2:42 and Word, Worship, Prayer, and Fellowship every day. May the Lord bless you and keep you as we are washed by the water of the Word.